Hello, friends. Greg Kokel here. The show is Stand to Reason, and today I am going to be spending this first hour standing to reason with my favorite Canadian. I never thought of it that way.
Am I the only Canadian you know?
Yeah, you are.
Yeah.
So it's always a safe.
Yeah.
Actually, it's not true. I know a few more.
Okay.
But you don't have a lot of competition there.
Okay. That's it.
So I can say with with complete candor, my favorite Canadian. Mm. Of course, you may recognize the voice. You don't see the face, unfortunately, no. This time, but you do on RPL, Red Pen Logic. Mr. Tim Barnett, our speaker from north of the border in Ontario. And what's it like there right now? Now, don't give me a degrees in like Celsius, all right?
Okay.
Because we will never be able to figure that out. Any general idea of what your
temperature? Well, it is. It's freezing, and
so that would be 32 degrees,
yeah,
using real numbers.
Yeah, and it is well below that, and we got a ton of snow today. So it's one thing when it's cold. I mean, that's just kind of unbearable. But when it snows, and then you get to go outside and, you know, play, that makes all the difference. You can put up with the cold when you got something to do out there.
Yeah, if you're dressed properly, and you better have a really warm hat on,
because
you don't have any natural protection on top,
yeah,
Timothy.
That's
I just
right.
came from Colorado Springs, just got in today. I was supposed to get in last night, but we got held over. It's snowing there.
Mm.
And then we're mechanical failures, so my wife and I, who came with me on the trip today, as it turned out, we left Sunday, but I spent the day with folks of the family yesterday, which went really great. And I just realized, Tim, I have not even mentioned this on the air for our other listeners. Yes, to ask for prayer support, whatever, but it went really well. I did a radio show, which looks like it will probably be aired in May. It's on the tactics issue, on the tactics book. But there was a video. Now they video the whole interview too. And the video may be going out on their channels, social media, Facebook, wherever, in the next few days, because that's easy to do. They don't need inventory, you know, like you do with a radio show to fit it into. And then I did probably, you know, I'm just thinking maybe 10 or 12 other short 5 to 10 minute vignettes on camera dealing with a whole host of other things, actually mostly classified in the tactics area and in the abortion or pro-life area, answering challenges that are going to show up in different places if they like what I said. So I had a nice, long, busy day. It was very productive. I was very happy. Great group of people. And so I'm just letting everybody know, ex post facto, so to speak. But it was cold there, 17 degrees and snowing. And I'm telling you something, in that situation, the snow was not a helper, because I wasn't, dressed up like Nanook in the North, you know,
yeah,
so I could roll in the snow and make angels and stuff.
Yeah.
I had my nice shoes on. I had my nice little sport coat on, and that was it.
Yeah,
I didn't even have my Columbo jacket, you know, to warm me up. My wife had a trench coat. She was in good shape, but man, that was cold for me. Anyway, the reason, first of all, glad to have you on board, Tim. Always glad to share this with you. And it occurred to me about a week and a half ago that I need to have you guys on more often. I mean, just for fun. Bringing you on, sharing the mic, catching up with you guys, taking questions. We're not able to do that together today because I know you got kids to take care of.
Mm-hmm.
Because let's see, it's like 7 o'clock where you're at, right? So
yeah,
by 8 o'clock your time, you got to put kids up. All right, I get mm-hmm. it. So we got you for an hour. So I'm not going to share you with other people right away. I'll take calls in our second half, our second segment. But I did want to catch up a little bit with you. And the biggest thing that's happening, I mean, with you and Stand to Reason right now, is what we lovingly call RPL, which mm-hmm. stands for Red Pen Logic. Available on YouTube. I tell people Red Pen Logic, three words, easy. Go to YouTube, type it in, and have a ball. That's what I say. So tell us about Red Pen Logic, how you came up with the idea, how it's developed over this last year, how many episodes we have, that kind of thing. Bring people who are not familiar with RPL up to date.
Sure. And I don't know if we've talked about this before on the air, but here's kind of the short of it. I was just going through social media like everyone else, you know, just scrolling through, reading tweets.
Not like me.
Well, yeah, you might be the exception. You're the exception.
I get so angry looking at all this nonsense, but I'm glad that you're on top of it. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I, you know, just going through, I think it was Twitter at the time, and I saw something that, man, I thought this is, it was a pro-choice challenge, and I thought, man, this has got logical fallacies in it. It's got factual mistakes. I mean, someone should take this to task. Someone should correct the mistakes here.
Yeah, and plus there were lots of thumbs up too, which is another thing that's kind of crazy, right?
Yeah, and this is the thing that some of these tweets have tens of thousands of likes and retweets. And so I thought, you know, it'd be funny if I just took the red pen like I did when I was a high school teacher and just correct it playfully. You know, I'm not trying to start something. I'm not trying to, I just want to point out the fallacies and have a bit of fun. And I did that and turned it into a graphic, shared it on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, and it just took off. And I did it again. And then finally we thought, you know what, let's make this more official. Let's turn this into a video and actually break it down, because we don't just want it to be, I mean, it's, I think people can see the mistakes when we highlight them with the red pen, but at Standard Reason, I mean, our mission is to train Christians, right? And we want to train them to think thoughtfully, clearly. And so what we did was we make these videos. They're usually about 5 to 7 minutes, and we're just taking you by the hand, step by step, showing you how to think through the issue, whatever the issue is in the tweet. And I would have never thought how popular these things would be. And the response that we've received, it's just incredible. I mean, we're up to 20,000, maybe 21,000 subscribers on YouTube. I mean, this is 8 months ago we started this. So this is unheard of. The graphics get shared hundreds of times on different platforms, Facebook and Instagram, that kind of thing. So we're having a lot of fun doing this, and people are learning and growing. And so we're going to keep doing it.
You know, I want to mention a couple of things about the project though. So people who watch it, these are roughly 5 minute long vignettes. So yeah, They're real easy. You're not committing yourself to a long podcast or anything. It's just a really fun deal. And it's not just Tim talking. Okay. Some of you don't know Tim. Okay. You haven't seen Tim. Now, Tim has, shall we say, trying to find the nicest way to put this, a very expressive face.
I know what I listened to a podcast on the Babylon Bee where you called me Mr. Rubberface. And I got people, we had people, I read the comments on RPL's YouTube. You read the comments, and some guy said, yeah, I heard this guy Kokol call you Rubberface. And they just said, I just came to see your face. And they stayed to watch the rest of the videos. So
well, then got hooked too. Because,
yeah, there you go.
See what's cool. So there is a very fetching visual element to these things, because as Tim says, we're going to try to critique these thought bombs, so to speak, you find on Twitter that people think are really great, but are in most cases deeply flawed. In fact, if it's not deeply flawed, we're not going to respond to it. You know, if it's a fair take and a fair whatever, then. But these are bad, and we're going to have a little fun while we do it. This is the way Tim puts it, you know, and he gets out his red pen, and the video portion of it as he's introducing it. So, and then he goes through it. Now, Tim works really, really hard at this, and it's very fast moving, and there are graphics that are worked in with it too when appropriate. And this editing process, and the graphics and all that, all the credit goes to Greg Cash. He's our video guy. And this guy is behind the scenes, but he's masterful. And I think he brings as much, not to take anything away from you, Tim, but that he brings as much skill to the process as you do. So you provide your incredible substance there, and he takes it and cuts it all together. That's why they have Academy Awards for directors. You could have editors, because you could have fabulous actors, but if it's not edited well, then their best qualities are not showcased. Yeah. But you guys work together as a masterful team, and it turns out all of these turn out to be fun, like you say, and lots because we're looking at you, and because you make such good points that it's not just taught but caught. People are carried along in the process of how to think about these things, and there's a fair, balanced, even-handed, reasonable refutation of the idea that seemed so popular to so many critics when they read it the first time.
Yeah.
Okay? And I didn't... Didn't you get a pushback once? I think I saw a response once where a guy says, if our arguments are so bad, we don't need some weaselly, bald-headed Canadian guy. How do they put that? I can't remember. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I'm not sure.
It was kind of a put-down on you, but it was,
yeah.
In a way, they couldn't put down the substance, and so they went after you a little bit, and which was kind of silly.
Yeah,
and this kind of thing happened.
One of the complaints is, you know, some of these are low-hanging fruit. And I agree. I mean, I don't think any of the arguments we've critiqued were persuasive at all. But some people do. I mean, we did a whole video on a tweet where a guy made a pro-choice argument, and he compared the unborn human beings to tapeworms. Okay, tapeworms. And said, look, they're inside your body, they have a heartbeat, they feel pain. And he's trying to draw this argument, he's trying to make an argument from analogy. Right. But it was a false analogy. It was a bad analogy.
Well, the things that he was analogizing were not relevant to our moral argument. You know, yeah, they got a heartbeat,
right.
Maybe they're inside, but they're tapeworms, right? Okay,
yeah,
I'm sorry, I'm jumping in, Tim. But
The complaint was, look, this is too easy, low-hanging fruit. Here's the thing. There were over 20,000 people that liked that tweet from essentially a no-namer on Twitter. This person had like 1,000 followers, and yet that tweet had 20,000 likes. How does that work? Well,
yeah.
People thought that was a compelling argument.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw the same argument was shared as a meme on Facebook. So we took it on.
Yeah.
And we responded to it.
By the way, if it is low-hanging fruit, the point is there's a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
Which isn't a good – that's not good. I mean,
yeah.
What that means is there are a lot of arguments against Christian views that are so bad, they're really easy to refute.
Yeah.
So no big deal to you, Tim, that you're refuting all of these arguments that are really easy to refute. Well, what does that say about the other side?
Mm-hmm.
If they're so easy to refute and there's so much low-hanging fruit.
Yeah.
And so this is why I think this is really valuable, because it does help people to see how thinking works. And it's funny. I know the script, right? So before it goes up, I know what you're doing and everything. When I still watch it, I still laugh at it, and I'm chuckling, and I'm saying, that's just great. That's a super enterprise. So
Did you watch the one coming out this week on the Trinity? Have you watched it?
No, I haven't. I think the last one I saw was the blooper one.
Okay.
Because after doing almost a year's worth of work, you got a bunch of false starts, you know, for your computer. You do a great job, and a lot of people really love the blooper reel. So all of this is available at YouTube. You don't even have to find anything special. Just type in Red Pen Logic, and there you'll see Mr. Barnett's rubbery face doing a fabulous job. Harvesting all this low-hanging fruit of bad arguments. good for you, Tim. I'm so thrilled about RPL. It doesn't seem, though, a lot of people that are, and it's hard to quantify this, but it seems we're attracting a lot of people that were not stand a reason people. We're drawing new people into our community with RPL, and we always love that.
Yeah, it's been awesome to see people discover Stand to Reason through YouTube. I mean, we've always had a YouTube presence, but this is such a unique thing. It's drawing in kind of a new audience than we're used to. So that's awesome. It's great.
Yeah, and we can draw them into other aspects of Standard Reason that they can benefit from, our website, str.org, our Solid Ground and mentoring letter. And by the way, this is an opportunity for me to mention something about this, because I almost never do this. I'm so focused on content and stuff. I don't do the yeoman's job of self-promotion. But if you are a listener and you do not get the monthly training material that we send out, you need it, okay? Every other month I write about a 3,500-word article called the piece is called Solid Ground, okay? And then the alternating months, about an 800-word single-page mentoring letter. And some things, as I've said before, are caught, not taught, but some things are taught. And so this is a way of me teaching. And a lot of times there's series or there's sequences, and just about everything I've ever published in a book showed up first in a Solid Ground. And so I repurpose it, you know, into a book, and then people read the book and they don't know if they were part of Standard Reason, our community. This is the kind of good stuff they're going to get on a regular basis. So it's very easy to subscribe. It doesn't cost anything. Just go to our website. And I used to say scroll down to the bottom where it says subscribe, but I just noticed when you go to our homepage, in the upper right-hand corner, there's a little red block that says subscribe. So It's really, really easy. Just hit that, fill out the information. We'll send it to you virtual. We'll send it to you snail mail, however you like. And then there's other little tidbits of training that we mix in over the course of a month that we'd like to send to you too. Also that we can build you up and, as Tim just mentioned, train you as an effective ambassador for Christ. We train Christians. We're a discipleship enterprise, okay? Yeah. And we want to disciple and mentor you. Now, with that in mind, Tim, let me just make a transition. You recently did some work. Well, tell us about it. It was a university-level interaction, teaching, Q&A that had to do with an area which is really one of your strengths and expertise, and that is the whole relationship of science and as some people would put it, faith. I think It's an unfortunate way of putting it. We'll talk about that in a moment. But science and religion, science and Christianity, that whole area has drawn a lot of attention. What exactly were you involved with? Set the stage for that.
Sure. So we hadn't, with the lockdown, a lot of events over the last few months. You know, they got either moved to online or some just got canceled. But one of the events that stayed on the calendar was this event called Relevant. It was a series. They were having keynote talks all week. I was the first one on a Monday night. And my task was to give a 20-minute talk on the compatibility between, or answering the question, are science and faith compatible? And then after that 20-minute kind of mini talk, there was going to be a 45-minute Q&A followed by another hour, because people were so interested in this. So we ended up doing about 2 hours total on this topic. Now, here's
the thing.
Was
the second hour Q&A too?
The second hour was Q&A. In fact, what they did was the first 45 minutes was people could put their questions on this program called Slido. And essentially what happens is they put the question on there and then people vote for the questions, and certain questions more votes. And So that's the one they ask.
That happened at a summit event I did a week ago, and people voted up. So it moves up the column, and then we end up doing the most popular question.
It actually is a great way to do it, because a lot of people have the same questions. And then what they did was, because they wanted the students to be able to actually interact with us as speakers, so they said, okay, what we're going to do is give you a Zoom link, and we're going to move you over into this Zoom call. And so we went from about 250 students to about, I forget if it was 100 students that came and stayed for the Zoom. And what they would do is they'd unmute themselves and ask the question directly to us.
Yeah, that's great.
Was really cool.
Here's
the thing.
Was this mostly college students?
This was,
Christian,
that's right.
Non-Christian, give us the
So. This was going to be a university event. It was actually two universities, University of Toronto and McGill University, which is in Quebec. And so it was a Canadian event. And And so we typically do church events, right? That's, I don't know about you, but that makes up most of my church conferences, church events. So it's a lot of friendlies, you know? And my experience with university events is you get many more people who, you know, they're still friendly, but they don't agree with our position.
Right.
So I wanted to make sure I was prepared for this event. And I hadn't, I mean, it's one of those things where you get a bit, you feel rusty. I know you say, trust the gift, trust the gift. And I need to do that better. But I was nervous because I hadn't spoken in a few months, especially on this topic. And, you know, it'd been December, this was into January. So I gave you a call. You know, I started hitting the book, so to speak, and, you know, writing down, okay, here's a question. How would I answer this? Here's a question. How would I answer this? And I think it was the night before the event, or maybe two nights before the event, you know, I said, look it, I got to call the boss. And you were in Colorado at the time, I think doing a summit event.
Yeah, I was.
And you spent an hour on the phone with me, just, you know, we were tossing back and forth some questions and answers and that kind of thing. And I think that's when you had the idea. You're like, you should just come on the show and we should do this kind of thing.
Right.
And so I had written down questions, that came up in the course of that event. And I had some other questions here. And so I thought it'd be interesting to kind of go through that process, you know, for 40 minutes or something.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. Yeah, and this, when I think of this broader issue, the challenge, I think that, and I don't know if this was kind of voted up to the top of the list or not, but it seems to me it's the kind of foundational challenge that that is unsettling both to Christians and to those who might be considering Christianity but have a commitment to science. Mm-hmm. And that is, you can put this in different ways, but I think the normal way they put it, isn't faith opposed to science?
Yeah.
Isn't there a conflict? How can you live in both worlds? I mean, all the time. Maybe you could do the faith thing on Sunday, but the rest of the week you're in the real world, right? That's science, and you only have to pretend for one day a week. But that's the way people actually think about it, that there's this split that goes on. And I imagine that was one of the first things that you had to address.
Yeah, this was, the topic of the night was, is science compatible with faith? And so to answer that question, you really got to define your terms, right? What do you mean by faith? Because there are some definitions, I mean, the most popular definitions from the new atheists are that make science and faith completely at odds with each other. Because, and we did a whole red pen on this, actually, on this question of faith. If you define faith as belief without evidence, or pretending to know things you don't know. That's what Peter Boghossian. Yeah, Portland State University. That's how he puts it. And so if that's how you define faith, then if you have science over here with all this evidence, then of course the polar opposite is faith. It's blind. It's a leap in the dark, this kind of thing. But the question is, is that biblical faith? Is that the kind of faith that Christians have? And so I know that, you know, when I was in university studying physics and challenged in my faith and discovering Stand to Reason, man, it had to be one of the first articles I read was something that you wrote, Greg. I don't know if you titled it Faith Is Not Wishing or something like that. And you did such a great job defining and going through and arguing for a proper understanding of what biblical faith is.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know if you want to, I don't want to steal your thunder here about how, go for it. How would you define faith?
Well, okay. Here is I have said this many times before that I don't use the word faith in discussion about my Christianity unless I am criticizing the use of the word, essentially, because I think the word has been so corrupted for our use because of the misunderstanding. People subconsciously just apply the words leap of or blind to the word faith. This is, well, faith is, of course, a leap. It's blind. There is no evidence for faith. This is built into their reaction. And so when somebody like Peter Boghossian is giving his definition, he's just characteristic of a whole host of atheists who do the same thing. They are simply speaking in a somewhat reflexively. They are just saying, this is what, well, we all know that this is what it is. Well, in Story of Reality, I go into more depth on this problem. I said, you know, you could define, anybody can define any word any way they want for themselves. But if they're going to critique somebody else's view, they can't make up their definition and assault that. That's a straw man. They've got to deal with the definition that the people they're critiquing have. And our definition is from Scripture, and it's explicitly and implicitly. In other words, the way people use the word, the way it's defined and the way it's used. Now, it's really the way it's used is simply, and the word I use as a synonym for faith then, is trust. Mm-hmm. Because the biblical word pisteo, or some form of that Greek word that's translated faith or believe, means to put one's trust in. Now, you don't have to think very hard about this, Tim, to realize that when somebody asks you to trust them, a little word pops up in your mind, especially if they want you to trust you on something really important. And that word is why, right? Why?
Yeah,
should
of
I?
Course.
Yeah, why should I trust you? And so that's why in the use of the appeal for trust in the New Testament, especially, there are reasons that are given so that someone would be willing to trust in the thing in question. And so reasons and trust go together, or to put it otherwise, reason and faith go together. The opposite of faith is not reason. The opposite of faith is unbelief.
That's right.
Duh. The opposite of reason is not faith. The opposite of reason is irrationality.
Yeah.
You know, it's possible to have irrational unbelief, and it's also possible to have rational, that is, reasonable faith. And the verse that I go to, I could talk about this for hours, obviously.
Yeah.
But the verse that is the easiest for people to remember is it's in the last chapter of the Gospel of John, where John tells the reason he's writing the entire gospel. Mm-hmm. And what he says is, many other signs and wonders. Now, what's that? That's a miracle. Many other signs and wonders Jesus performed that I have not included in this account. Okay, he goes on to say later in the chapter, it would fill all the books of the world. He's speaking hyperbolically there. Like, I mean, Jesus did a lot, but he focused in the Gospel of John to seven. Why did he give us these seven signs? He tells us, in order that you might believe that Jesus is the Son of God and the Messiah, and in believing have life in his name. Okay. Now, if the Bible is so much against evidence and really in favor of blind faith, then why does John say, I've given all of this evidence so that you will put your confidence in Jesus, who is the Son of God and the Messiah, and here's the result you'll have when you do it? That, to me, is the single verse that does the most work to make this point, though, as you know, Tim, there are dozens of them.
Yeah. John is doing the exact opposite of what he should be doing if he believed in blind faith.
Right.
Faith without evidence. Right.
Right. Right.
I was just going to say, the whole gospel is evidence. And so here you can see in our question, is faith opposed to science? Of course not, at least not in principle on this. You can have trusting in what you have good reason to believe is true.
There it is.
And that, I mean, that's what faith is. And then maybe over here in science, you got some good reasons to back up whatever it is, Christianity or God or whatever. Mm-hmm. And those things come together.
Mm-hmm. So maybe a simple way of looking at it, and this is the way I've broken it down in the past. I'm not sure how you responded to it there, and you can tell us, but it depends on what you mean by faith. If you are using a biblical understanding of faith, there is no inherent conflict with using an empirical methodology to discover things, truths about the physical world. All right. But it also somewhat depends on what you mean by science, because there is a way of characterizing science, just like a way of characterizing faith, that puts science at odds with certain religious claims. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, of course. That's kind of another step, right? We talked about defining our terms. So our faith in God and science compatible with each other. I want to know what you mean by faith. I want to know what you mean by God. And then we'll come back to this because it relates to a common challenge about God of the Gaps and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But also, what do you mean by science? Because there are some definitions of science. You could take a whole philosophy of science course and, you know, and wrangle about, you know, the definition of science. But at Standard Reason, we talk about kind of two general ways it's being used. And one is a methodology, like the scientific method. Follow this step and you get to your conclusion, you know. But there's also a way it's being defined philosophically, right? And there's a way in which the philosophy is determining what conclusions are permissible, right? And so you may want to say more about this. There's methodological naturalism, mm-hmm. that's sometimes equated with science. And then there's this thing called philosophical naturalism, this worldview that ultimately determines what is allowed in science and what's not.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes when people say a thing is not scientific, they're looking at the discipline itself in question, and they're saying this is not following the kind of methods that are commonly accepted as reliable methods to determine truth about the physical world. So here I might contrast astronomy with astrology. Mm-hmm. Okay, they both deal with heavenly bodies, but they're two entirely different kinds of disciplines. Astronomy follows a pattern or follows a method that allows that has the ability to give us true facts about the world. I mean, a demonstrable ability. Okay, astrology though, that's about stars, but that's a whole different kind of. That's not science. Because it doesn't employ the methodology of science, okay? So that's a definition or understanding of science that neither of us have any qualms about. And in fact, and we were talking about this off the air, and maybe we'll get to it in a bit, this scientific methodology is something that was birthed out of a Christian worldview. And this is something I know some skeptics kind of scoff at this notion, but this is absolutely, totally, and completely historically quantifiable. Yeah. And we've both done it. You know, virtually every founder of disciplines of modern science was a biblical committed theist. You know, they may not have all been, like Newton was, maybe he didn't believe in the Trinity, so... But nevertheless, he still held to a biblical worldview, and it was the worldview that it was a science starter. It wasn't a science stopper, as a matter of fact. But you have this methodology that's birthed in an environment of worldview that is the Christian worldview, and so there's no problem there. The problem is when you have a competing worldview that comes out of the Enlightenment called materialism, and that says, well, there is nothing but matter, all right? Science studies matter in motion. That's its province, basically, and that's all there is. And so you are not allowed then to let science intimate the existence of something that philosophically we have declared doesn't exist. So not only do you have to use the right methodology, that's one definition of science, now you have to have the right kind of answers.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have the right kind of answers, and those are the answers that comport with metaphysical, empirical cause and effect kind of thing. Okay. Now, by the way, it turns out, and you know this, Tim, 99.9999999% of the time when we're operating with the physical realm, well, naturalism is the appropriate way to explain things because it's totally adequate to explain the effects involved. So, you know, we hear thunder, we don't think, well, that's God's bowling. The gods are bowling. No, we check it out and we find out about electricity and all that other stuff, so we have a naturalistic explanation. But it turns out there are a couple of things, not many, but a couple of things that do not lend themselves to that kind of explanation, where the methodology points directly to agency, to an agent. And, you know, there are things in science that we already do, forensic pathology, psychology, archaeology, paleontology. I mean, these are all disciplines that do employ the notion of agency. Even the scientific method, you've got to be careful that you do your stuff right and you're not cheating and all that other stuff for science to work. Mm-hmm. But when you start using agency or implying from the physical evidence that there might be an invisible creator or an invisible soul, well, then you violated science, but not the first kind.
Yeah.
The second definition. That is the metaphysics. And so this is another shell game that's going on in discussing this issue, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I want to go back to something you said just a moment ago about the history of science, because I made this point in my short little 20-minute talk, and someone asked the question, or it wasn't really a question, it was more of a statement. They said, well, everyone of that time believed in God, so what? You know, and I had actually thought about that question beforehand. You know, you have guys like Isaac Newton, Johannes Kepler, you know, Gregor Mendel and Robert Boyle and James Clerk Maxwell. I mean, the list just goes on and on. These are the guys we have units you know, science named after them. Right. And so was it just that they just believed in God because everyone did? But actually, when you do your homework, when you start looking into the history of science, you find out that these men weren't just like nominal believers in God. I mean, you find out that some of them wrote more about God and theology than science. And when they wrote their science, they attributed this stuff, like Newton in his Principia Mathematica, you know, his famous work. He says that, you know, the solar system that he was studying and the law of gravity could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an incredible, intelligent designer. I mean, so for these guys just to say, well, they all believed because that was what everyone did at the time, really misrepresents and misunderstands the faith that these men had in God and the role that God played in their science.
In their thinking. You know, it made me think, I wonder if all of these guys also brush their teeth. You know, and we wouldn't be saying, you know, all these guys brush their teeth, and you're claiming now that brushing teeth is what led to science. Now, that would be a ridiculous connection, because we're not just simply saying they held this belief and this thing happened later. That actually is a fallacy of post hoc ergo proctor hop. You know, the roosters cause the sun to rise, because when the roosters crow, it's dark out and then the sun comes up. You know, that's that kind of fallacy. And so they're accusing us of that kind of thing. But what, as you pointed out, it's that's an oversimplistic, shallow way of looking at it. Yeah, they all believed in God, and it is their belief in God that produced what it produced, and they declare it so. I mean, think about it. The universe, on their view, is created by an intelligent creator who made things in a certain order that we are to be able to subdue, if you will, control, manage the creation order there. And he gives us faculties that allows us to learn true information about the world. And so let's go out and figure some things out about how we made things and harness those things for ourselves. Mm-hmm. So it's not some casual, irrelevant connection between belief in God and the development of science, like you pointed out. There's an intrinsic connection, a causal element, a worldview foundation that makes the progress in science possible. And that's why for the most part, rose up in the West, not in the East, where they think the world is an illusion.
That's right. And I mean, just to drive home this point, if people want to check out a book by Tom Holland, not the actor who played Superman, the historian, Tom Holland, he wrote a book recently called Dominion. And he was interviewed on a YouTube channel called Capturing Christianity. And it's fascinating because they're talking about science and secularism and a number of different topics. But when it came to science, Tom Holland said this. He said, without Christianity, we would not have science. We wouldn't have it. He said that, and this is another quote, he said that there are Goldilocks qualities about the Christian God that make science possible. Goldilocks qualities, like he talks about uniformity, regularity, the language of mathematics, having a mind to study. I mean, he just goes on and on about this. And so it's not just, well, science was going to come one way or the other. No, it wasn't like that. It wasn't going to come through the Greeks. It wasn't going to come through Islam. It came through the Christian understanding of God.
And you're leaving out another detail that's really important in this in Holland's remarks and his analysis.
What's that?
He's not a Christian.
Oh, that's right. Here's the thing. He certainly does not hold to the resurrection and so on. Now, what's interesting is since writing his book, he now calls himself a Christian, but only in the sense that he has been so impacted by Christianity in his thinking, his beliefs, that he wants to label himself that.
He wants to identify with that. But the point is when he wrote his book and came to his conclusions, he could not be accused, and this would be itself a fallacy if somebody did it.
Yeah.
You'd have to demonstrate distortion based on bias. But you can't even claim he had a bias in favor of Christianity to make this case.
That's right.
Because that wasn't his conviction. And ironically, I didn't know this detail that you just mentioned, but his study made him more favorable to Christianity a result of what he learned about the history of science.
Yeah. So he doesn't believe Jesus is God. He doesn't believe that, you know, Jesus rose from the dead. But he thinks that Christianity was the greatest force for good in the history of humanity.
So let me ask you another question here, Tim. So if it turns out that it, properly understood, faith is not opposed to properly understood science.
Yeah.
If it's not a philosophical battle, but we're just looking at a methodology giving evidence for things about the world, and Christians had spiritual convictions about the world that are largely unrelated to science, though there's some. What is that relationship then? How does say science inform religion, or how does religion inform science, or maybe not at all? Because I know there are some people who think of separate realms.
That's right.
The this noma.
Goes, I mean, non-overla- yeah, noma. Is that Carl Sagan? I think that's Sagan,
right? No, that's
right?
The guy from Harvard who's gone now.
Tim, now you're... Gould. Stephen Jay Gould.
I was afraid that you... having a senior moment, and you were catching it from me.
I haven't had dinner yet.
Yeah, Stephen Jay Gould called it non-overlapping magisteriums, or noma.
Yeah.
In a book that he wrote called The Rock of Ages. That's the way some people will kind of characterize the relationship. So how do you do that?
So there are two areas that are completely separate. I think that, and again, this goes back to, you study the history of science, again, Kepler and Newton and many others, they acted as if there was two books. God created, revealed himself in two ways, through nature and through scripture, and both needed to be interpreted, okay? And so there's a way in which, you know, sometimes our study of nature, God's, you know, book of nature, will help us in coming to truths that maybe are maybe ambiguous or less clear in scripture. And here's one example. There were people, I mean, go back to Calvin and Luther, they understood certain verses to mean that the earth was the center of the solar system. So a geocentric view. That's how they understood those passages. And it was Kepler, and it was and Copernicus and Galileo and others who said, no, when we look through our telescopes, when we have a model for the solar system, the sun is at the center. And so here's a way in which, you have science kind of informing our interpretation of scripture.
Our hermeneutic. To me, the classic example is the sun rising and the sun setting.
Yeah.
You know, that sounds like the earth is not moving. The sun is the thing that's moving around the earth. And that might be. But of course, we even talk. I can look at my iPhone right now and find out what time is sunset. We still use the same language, but it's the language we realize now because of the science that it's the earth going around the sun, not the sun. So why do they say that? Why do we say it now? Why do they say it in scripture? Because that's the language of appearance.
That's right.
It's just the way we talk about how things appear visibly, and it's a very natural way to talk it. So there's an example of science informing our hermeneutic without undermining the authority of scripture.
That's right. I mean, these men still took, I mean, Galileo, you know, there's a lot of misunderstanding about that whole thing, and we don't have to get into it, but he believed the Bible, and he just thought, you know what, these verses need to be reinterpreted from a geocentric view to a heliocentric view. But then there's times where, you know what, our Christianity, our understanding of scripture will inform our science. And so, I mean, Christians have always held, or most Christians have held, that the universe had a beginning. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Mm-hmm. Now, there wasn't any scientific evidence for that until 100 years ago, okay? I mean, the jury was still out as far as science goes until really Einstein came along. And then there was more recent discoveries. But there was some philosophical arguments that, you know, we don't have to talk about here. But here's an example where, look at, we can, our religion, let's just say, can kind of inform what we might expect in science, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, well, when you have Big Bang cosmology, that this is kind of 1960s and onward, is pretty much accepted. And I know Christians are a little uncomfortable with that, especially if you're a young earther. But I think they don't realize how well it fits in with our own biblical cosmology.
Yeah.
In the beginning, bang, you know, everything comes into existence. Those go hand in glove. Mm-hmm. And so this is where you have what appears to be many to be a fact of that science has uncovered about the origin of the universe that fits perfectly with the revelation that we have about the origin of the universe.
Yeah.
And it isn't like there's going to be a gazillion things like that, because my own view is that it is not the case that they're non-overlapping magisteriums, but I don't think they overlap a whole lot. You have theological things that are unrelated to any physical things, and you have physical mm-hmm. things that are broadly unrelated, except in the sense that it's kind of hard to look very closely at anything physical that is in the natural world without realizing that, gee, this probably didn't happen on its own by accident. Mm-hmm. And I know people think, well, it was the accident of evolution and the blind watchmaker and all of that. But they keep talking about Mother Nature this and Mother Nature that. Why do they talk that way? And I'll tell you why they talk that way. Because it seems like a person got involved mm-hmm. in organizing things in a very precise way. Now, they don't want to give credit to father, so they give credit to mother. But it's a betrayal, I think, of a common sense intuition, which Doug Axe calls the design intuition, that the world was created and designed, which suggests maybe also for a purpose. And incidentally, you don't have to read the Bible to get this. This is something that you can get by looking at the scientific realm. In fact, you might, or the physical realm that science studies. Timmy, you might be aware of this too. I've heard, isn't there that one of the scientists, you know, in this area, he said, you know, we have to keep telling ourselves, this is not design. This happened by an accident. This is an accident. And the reason is because the evidence of their eyes, the prima facie mm-hmm. evidence of their own eyes, is that this is a highly designed thing. But their philosophy doesn't allow them to go there, and so they have to persuade themselves otherwise.
Yeah, Richard Dawkins, I think you're thinking of Francis Crick, but Richard Dawkins makes a similar statement in the opening page of, I don't know if it's A Blind Watchmaker. Where he says that biology is a study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for purpose. And I think you can't deny it. I mean, it just, things look designed. The question is, are they actually designed? And this is what ID proponents will argue. And so look at there. I agree with you. Our science can inform our religion, our hermeneutic. And sometimes, and again, this would be rare. I actually don't think the Bible is a science textbook. Okay. And some people treat it as if it is. And the first few chapters of Genesis, I think, have a lot more to do with meaning than measure. You know, it's not about science. That's not primarily what it's about. We can talk about that. I think that actually is another question that came up.
Let me just put it this way then. You and I talked about this on the phone, and it seemed to me when people say there's all this conflict between science and religion, there's really only one thing that is at the heart of that claim, and that is old Earth evolution and young Earth creation. Would that be a fair way of putting it?
I think so. I think when people say there's a conflict, what they have in their mind is young Earth creation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or evolution, one of those two things.
And so what do you say then to a secular public regarding that apparent conflict?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It comes up a lot. And my first move is to say, look, Christians disagree on this issue. This is an in-house discussion.
Regarding the age of the universe.
Regarding the age of the earth and how do we interpret, you know, these first few chapters in Genesis. This is like a third tier issue that brothers and sisters in Christ disagree over. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so the conflict is only there if science is right about the age of the earth being millions of years and the young earthers are that's the only view, you know.
Well, if they're right that the Bible teaches a young Earth,
yes,
and the scientists are right that the Earth is old, then you have a quantifiable conflict. But this is what's in question.
That's right.
Does the Bible actually teach that? Now, for us to say it this way means that we're not young Earthers, and we respect those who have this particular view. But it turns out that this is what I think is important. There's a very, very, very small space, it seems, where there is a genuine conflict between the claims of science and the claims of Bible-believing Christians. And it's not all Bible-believing
Some
Bible-believing Christians. Now, there is this broader issue of evolution, too, but that's another one where, though neither of us accept the larger Darwinian picture, there are people who, let's put it this way, qualifying, we don't believe this, but if it turned out that the Darwinian model was true, God could still exist, and all of the stuff in the Bible that is theologically significant could all be true because it doesn't depend on the answer to this question. Hinge on this at all.
Yeah.
So this point of conflict is not even a relevant point of conflict theologically.
Yeah, it's not a major, it's not like at the center of Christianity, so that I need to now abandon Christianity. You know, if evolution's true, I must abandon Christianity. No, that's not true. I have to rethink maybe some of, you know, maybe the historical Adam or something like that. Although there's theistic evolutionists who believe in a historical Adam. So, I mean, it's more complicated than just saying, look at Christians hold this belief, science claims this, there's a conflict. No, I would want to ask, kind of using our Columbo approach, someone says there's a conflict, then I want to ask, where is it? Show me the conflict.
And show me the significance of that conflict and the big picture of the truthfulness of Christianity. And we both agree that historical Adam is a real important player, so we're not kind of giving the subtle nod to theistic evolution. But we're just saying we don't want people to make that question be bigger than it is and make this kind of inform the entire relationship of science and religion. I only got 2 minutes here left, Tim. This like blew by this whole week, this whole hour, but
it did.
I I want you to answer this question here. Should a scientist believe in miracles?
Yeah, I mean, and this is the kind of thing that comes up all the time. Like, you know, can or should a scientist believe in miracles? And the answer is, of course they can. I mean, it's almost as if, like, well, scientists, it's almost like it's presumed that scientists should be naturalists. Like, mm-hmm. they can't, and what I mean by that is, you can only believe in the natural. It's almost
no
like
supernatural.
Asking, yeah, no supernatural. Should a scientist believe in beauty? Should a scientist believe in morality? Should a scientist believe that the world was not created 5 minutes ago with the appearance of age? You know, the kinds of questions, beauty, morality, these kinds of things, is metaphysical or ethical.
And they're outside of science.
They're outside of science. I think what happens in these discussions is, and we didn't have time to talk about it, but sometimes there's a scientism that kind of gets imported in, you know, like, that's the only way you can know something. And scientists, you know, they know what they know because, you know, it's science. And mm-hmm. anything outside that shouldn't be believed because right. it's not science.
Yeah, so a miracle wouldn't be a function of natural processes. And yeah. we can only believe things that are a function of natural processes. Therefore, if you're really a scientist, you shouldn't believe in it. My view is very simple. If there is good reason to believe a miracle has taken yeah. place, that is something that cannot be explained by the forces of nature, which mm-hmm. is not a violation of natural law. It's an exemption of natural law. It's a big difference. That God may have had something to do with, well, then I think they should believe in it. And it does not assault their commitment to science at all. So, look, I got 15 seconds before my music comes up. Let me just say this, Tim. I think you're fabulous, and I wish we had another 2 hours. And I know you got to take care of your
kids. Say that again.
Yeah,
I want to hear.
I think you're fabulous. But I say that to all my guests. So, yeah. all my favorite Canadians. I know you got to run. Take care of your kids. And sorry to see you go, but thank you for joining me this hour, and we'll have you on again before
sure.
too long.
Thanks for having me.
All righty. Tim Barnett, stand to reason. Be sure to check out Red Pen Logic mm-hmm. on YouTube. You'll have a lot of fun. You'll learn a few things at the same time. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Give him heaven. Bye-bye now.